Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Monday, June 26, 2017. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine, the 72-year-old monthly of intellectual probity, political analysis, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. Join us at commentarymagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and then ask you to pay $19.95 for a digital subscription and $29.95 for an all-access... I can never say that effectively. An all-access digital, all-access subscription, not just digital, that gets you our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. With me, as always, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
Well, it's never a dull day with the Dodgers, guys, because we have a lot of news. There's a lot of news. We've got Supreme Court decisions coming flying fast and furious, and we've got I don't even know what it's called, the Senate bill, the Senate health care bill, which has the unfortunate initials of the Ashkenazic breast cancer gene, BRCA or BRCA, as those of us who are unfortunate enough to have had experience with it know. These are also the initials of the Senate version of the House bill that is now up for possible passage this week or next, or failure. Very interesting political situation. Remember, this whole thing was left for dead 2.5 months ago. It was revived in the House. The Senate has now managed to come up with a bill that is considerably more lenient, less draconian, more financially generous in some fashion or other, in ways that will probably curtail its effectiveness as a money-saving device that will make it possible for the House and Senate to come up with a significant tax cut later on in the year, but nonetheless. So this could happen or couldn't happen as of the moment, I believe, Noah Rothman. There are five senators who are saying they will not vote for the bill in its current form.
Yeah, I think it's five.
Okay, it's five. However, we are told, I believe, that this could be a kabuki play. We're seeing shadow puppets dancing on the walls that Mitch McConnell, the very able legislator who is the Senate Majority Leader, has left room for emendation of the bill in ways that will please the five people who may not vote for it and allow them to claim victories over the bill as it stands, and thus allow them to support at least three of them to support it. Thus, the bill can pass with 51 votes in the Senate. Would that be correct? Or even if it's 50-50, it passes also because Mike Pence, the vice president, can cast the deciding vote.
Yeah, well, I think you'd still need three for that because they can only afford to lose two.
Okay.
Before it gets to 50-50, and then
I was told there would be no math, Noah.
This is the best I've ever done on a math question in my entire life. Okay, so I'm gonna revel in it. Yeah, I'm reminded of the healthcare process in the House where you had a bill that failed. And everybody walked away from it thinking that the effort was dead. Of course, you can't walk away from healthcare. So they went back to it and revived it. And you had the same objections over minutia from the notably from conservatives in the Freedom Caucus who were persuaded, not just necessarily
this
because—
This is the House bill we're talking about.
The House bill, not just because the legislation was changed in order to address their genuine and valid concerns, but because leadership needed the vote. And leadership got the vote. It was about the Republican agenda and the Trump era and making the most of this particular moment in history. And that has a tendency to carry the day in the Senate, too, and never underestimate Mitch McConnell. So, yes, we have some recalcitrant holdouts right now, but the notion that we won't get there is something that I think a lot of people are just dismissing outright, perhaps more so than they should be, actually, because these senators don't seem inclined to move, although Ted Cruz and Mike Lee, I believe, have both made plain where their objections could be relieved in certain specific areas.
Okay, so we've got them.
Not Rand Paul. Rand Paul's never going to vote.
Rand Paul will not vote for the bill. Ron Johnson of Wisconsin says it's not fair that it's being rushed through and they need more time. This is actually, I believe, a very foolish position that he is taking, because it strikes me that the longer the bill cooks on the floor, the more polling will come out that is unfavorable to it, the more pressure interest groups can levy on senators to come out against it, even if they were inclined to go for it. And so you'd be better off, you know, getting it out and taking your chances. Now, there's a whole process nobody understands because of the arcane rules of the Senate, where if the bill is allowed to go through on some procedural thing, then there is a moment at which the bill can be amended in a process known charmingly and delightfully as the Votorama. But it has to pass an initial vote in order to get to the Votorama, which is when you can start attaching amendments to the bill in some fashion or other. And that's where people could attach cutesy amendments that they could then claim had saved it. Okay, so that's where the Republicans are. Let's talk for a minute about where the Democrats are and where the liberals are upon the release of the details of the Senate bill. I am going to state for the record that I believe that the rhetoric that is being used in response to this bill represents a new level of policy hysteria, the likes of which we actually have not seen in this country in a very long time, if ever. That is to say, it is the general Democratic and liberal proposition that the passage of health care, a health care reform bill that attempts to fix problems with Obamacare, which is left unchecked, will collapse of its own weight, is in a death spiral, without question, is an act of mass murder by Republicans. That is not an extreme, well, come on, people. I mean, okay, Elizabeth, she's just so passionate, Elizabeth. But, I mean, it's not mass murder. But, you know, you have to understand why. It is, I believe, the default position of the Democratic Party that this bill is an act of mass murder because it allows states to experiment with how they deal with Medicaid funding.
This was always a problem with healthcare reform in general, in creating the conditions where the public believes that government is responsible for the dispensation of healthcare benefits and health insurance, is that there are moral hazards associated with it. It will inevitably lead to the incentive to force people to take advantage of healthcare programs. It creates the incentive to regulate everything you do in your life, and It makes it so that you can raise the temperature and the rhetoric to the point where you can say somebody who wants to touch this bill is going to kill everybody, because that's how it is overseas. That's how it is with the NIH. If you do mess with the NIH, people really do die.
You mean the NHS?
NIH is our National Institutes of Health.
Right. So we're getting our acronyms all bollocksed up here. Because acronyms are our future, yes.
Right. No, that's an excellent point. I mean, that's the problem with centralization of policy generally. When everything is put in one place, if you flick one switch, you affect many more people, or at least you can make that case. But there is a sort of rhetorical arms race now. So you can't. Everything has to be stated. Every objection and every call for support has to be stated now in these sort of absolute end-of-the-world terms. That, I think, won't work in and of itself. But if there's a kernel of substance that can be taken away from the mass murder charge, that might sit well with some people.
Okay, so this is all speculation. There's no way of knowing, and there's no way of telling. The question is, and Noah, we talked about this last week. So you were away, and then you know, Americans, you had the revelation that most Americans aren't bathing in partisan politics, and they aren't following it this closely and all of that. And I'm wondering whether those Americans, real people who aren't, you know, drenched in every detail of all this, will hear this rhetoric and say, oh, come on. Like, okay, you know, they all hate each other. They all stink. Because, look, so Trump and the Republicans, I mean, maybe I agree with them, maybe not. Maybe they care for the rich and stuff, but they don't want to kill 5 million people. I mean, come on. It's just, you know, politics stinks. And then maybe it doesn't work. Like, because it's so out of phase. you know, and people now they say by a tiny, you know, by like 51% in a poll, people say they support the Affordable Care Act, you know, Obamacare. But of course, they support it without knowing what it is. And a year ago, they disliked it. And so the notion that this support is like now, you know, rock solid and something that, you know, Democrats can take to the bank and that will destroy Republicans as surely as Obamacare itself destroyed Democrats, that's a problematic thing. Because if a bill passes, and what it does is it allows for experimentation, it attempts to create new, you know, modalities for the delivery of healthcare outside of this failing system, and you know, allows the states that want to expand Medicaid to do it. It just won't pay them. It won't, you know, won't supply limitless amounts of money for that to happen. So we're hearing the horror stories. We're hearing very little defense of the bill. You know, and why are we hearing very little defense of the bill? Because the President of the United States cannot, not only can the President of the United States not defend a bill or make a coherent argument for anything or use his authority to kind of frame the discussion and create a framework in which we can talk about it. But as Noah points out, because he is doing something entirely different with it. What is he doing, Noah?
He's undermining the Republican position to his
own
benefit.
First he did it to the House, and now he's doing it to the Senate.
Yeah.
Right? So how is he doing that?
Well, first of all, he's confirming anonymously sourced reports, which is lovely for this administration to go about it that way. But he told Republicans in a closed-door meeting that he thought the House version of the bill was mean, and he wants to see, quote, more heart in the second bill. That was an anonymous report that Sean Spicer confirmed, and the president later took to the trail in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to similarly confirm. He said he wanted to see more heart. Now, conservatives know what it means when Democrats say they want to see more heart in a piece of legislation. It means more taxpayer dollars for spending programs, and that's precisely what the president means. He said very explicitly that he wants, quote, more money in this bill. Doesn't care where it goes, doesn't care what it's supposed to do. It's just about throwing cash at the problem. And that's just how he thinks. He thinks like an unreformed 20th century big city Democrat. And okay, that's how big city Democrats operate.
By the way, there is a great piece today in Politico, I commend it to your attention, by Jack Schaefer, who I think has written probably the most revelatory piece about Trump that we've seen so far in some ways. Because he says that Trump's model, without knowing it really, is that Trump is trying to govern as the mayor of America, that he is most like Ed Koch, a person that he actually despised in his approach, and he wants to govern like America's mayors, you know, have a great, particularly in New York, have a great deal more executive authority than presidents do. They have weak legislatures, and they can sort of kind of force their will upon, you know, cities are much smaller, much more cohesive, and it's much easier to make a difference there. And that, you know, his frustrations with governance at the national level are the frustrations of somebody who thought that he could govern like a mayor, but in fact the president, of course, has many, many constitutional checks and balances on his authority.
So if I could address your point, I think now as it stands, the notion that the line that Republicans want to kill millions of people with this legislation will fall flat, if only because it's not completely unheard of. In 2013 and 2012, you had people like Robert Reich saying that the Republican budget is social Darwinism and there will be bodies in the streets. And Salon has been publishing pieces about Republican legislation trying to kill people for a long time, for the fringes. But it's out there, and it's sort of a tired and trite line to gin up political opposition. The only concern I have there is that, also in that piece that I wrote for CommentaryMagazine.com, is the fact that Republicans and conservatives can't get on the same page, because they're all having a conflicting message here. And when it comes to President Trump seeking to absorb as little political criticism over this bill as possible and let most of it fall on the shoulders of the Senate, his defenders in the media are allowing that line to pass, and they're filing dispatches from an alternate universe in which Donald Trump has no responsibility for the outcome of this bill, and the Republicans are to blame, and Democrats are to blame, and Republicans forgot about capitalism, and all sorts of nonsense. So they're all sort of at cross purposes here, and as long as that dynamic holds, then there will be there won't be a concerted effort to counter the Democratic
line. Okay, but remember what I said at the beginning of the podcast, which is that if this bill is a throwing money at it bill, there are deleterious consequences over the next couple of months for the Trump agenda. I would say that if you could figure out what the Trump agenda, domestic agenda is, it is he's got to stimulate a disproportionate economic growth, or at least disproportionate based on the growth of the last 15 years. The only way that he sees to do that, aside from deregulation, which is an important thing, is a significant tax cut. The only way he can get a tax cut through is through the reconciliation process. The reconciliation process is the process by which a Senate bill can pass by 51 votes instead of requiring cloture at 60 votes. The only way a reconciliation bill works is if it is revenue neutral and it does not increase the deficit. The only way that Trump can get money for a tax cut is through cutting elsewhere. And the money that was going to go for the tax cut was going to come from the health care savings, which in the House bill, after it was revised and revised, were somewhere around $150 billion. And the Senate bill, presumably, will reduce that in some fashion because there'll be more federal Medicaid spending. So let's say the Senate bill, we don't know, there's going to be a score later today, but say the Senate bill comes in at $100 billion. He's not going to have much money for this tax cut. That's not a lot of money. It sounds like a lot of money. It's not a lot of money in a $14 trillion economy. And so his need to stimulate the economy through a gargantuan tax cut is harmed by his approach on healthcare, which is to solve the immediate problem of looking heartless by saying he's not heartless, these other guys are heartless, which of course is bad party leadership. And you know, they're carrying water for him as much as they are for themselves, and a lot of people are going to take a vote that's going to hurt them when they face re-election next year. And he is potentially hurting his own agenda by not being able to make the argument that saying that the current system is better than what would follow it does not take into account the fact that the current system is unsustainable and will collapse of its own weight, or this element of the current system that is not strictly private, right? Which is most Americans are still getting their healthcare through their employer. So they're not really going to be that terribly affected, but socially, Medicare, Medicaid, and Obamacare recipients might hurt. If you don't make an argument that this will be better for them in the long run because the system as it stands is a house of cards that's about to collapse.
But I mean, I think a huge...
And he has to make that argument because Mitch McConnell is not an argument maker. Paul Ryan's an argument maker, but he gets too deep in the weeds. This is a job for the leader of the party, the figurehead of the United States, the man who wants to sign this legislation, and he is uniquely ill-suited to that task simply as a matter of fact.
But the huge problem in articulating an argument for this bill is coming together on what the actual purpose of the bill is at this point. I mean, we know that it's to define sort of Trump's power, the presidency or the Republican age, but it's really to offer something different than the system that's going to collapse. Okay, so it's going to be different. Better for whom? Is it better based on some enduring political principle? Is it better because it's freer? Is it better because it will provide more coverage? Trump wants it to be more full of heart. Is that why it's better? Is it not going to be full of heart? I mean, it is such a scrambled mix.
I think that's, you've put your finger on the issue precisely. Trump has no problem making the case that Obamacare is flawed and is going to fail and is going to collapse of its own weight. He can say that all day long. What he can't say is the benefits of this bill, a good alternative. He talks about how it's going to be great and terrific and just you wait and see and heart and money and soul and whatever. But he can't make a specific case in favor of this bill, and it seems nobody can, or nobody seems so inclined, with the exception of maybe Abbott Roy at Forbes.
Right.
That's about it.
Right. Well, in other words, if you're a real wonk, if you're a real want, you go read Yuval Levin in National Review. He'll explain to you the good, the bad, and the ugly in the bill. And the good in the bill, you need an advanced degree in, you know, budgetary policy and healthcare, you know, and healthcare financing to understand what's good in the bill.
But
I believe,
it was
always
ever best, right? I mean, this is always complicated policy.
Well, it's complicated policy. I believe both Ovik and Yuval when they say that there are elements of this bill that are genuinely innovative that can lead to vastly better outcomes both for the budget and for healthcare in general. They're complex pieces of limited reform that put together like a jigsaw puzzle can have a very serious positive effect. I believe that. It's very hard for me to. I've edited hundreds of thousands of words now on healthcare. I've read, many books, many other articles, everything like that. And you know, it really defeats you, even though I've engaged with it myself intellectually now for 20 years, and as an editor for a decade. It defeats you to really understand. The one big thing that everybody, I think, agrees on, if you're really serious about this, is that there is a fix that no one can think of making because it's too disruptive to the system. But that if you decoupled the healthcare tax break from the employer and gave it to the consumer, that would be the revolution that could upend everything, that would empower individuals to take care of their own healthcare, to worry about costs, not to think that they're getting stuff for free because the money vanishes from their paychecks into some other account, and so they go, oh, this is great, I'm only paying $10 for a copay, without having any general sense of what the inputs are. And of course also creates these insane distortions where these hospitals and other healthcare providers issue these psychotic bills for $40,000 for a 2-day stay in a hospital because they know that there's going to be a giant healthcare body that is going to negotiate that number down to $7,000 from $40,000, like a good negotiator, and individual people would have to do that, whatever. The whole point is that without that fix, which is the fix that everybody knows needs to happen and will not happen, all these changes are basically on the margins. That said, you still need a president who could read a speech that could make the case that what will come out of this is better. That's what Abe is saying, and that's not it. And it's a real
thing. Well, more so, he doesn't seem to have any interest in it politically in selling this bill. Now, at least not yet. He seems to want to allow
he wants to take a victory lap when it passes. And once more, you can see the raw political calculation in this, or the sort of native cunning in this, which is that he has no connection to anything. But if it passes, it's and by the way, even if it's unpopular, because remember, we're talking about a guy who learned that you can get elected president while having an approval rating of 35%. So all this talk about how, oh, the Republicans are really, they're going to hit a buzzsaw because of 57% of the public disapproves of this bill, or 60% disapproves. He's like, that's nothing. That's nothing. That's fine. Don't worry about that. Because I've proved that, popularity or and Obama proved it too.
I don't know if that's true. But Obama, otherwise, he'd be more cautious about distancing himself from this bill.
No, but I'm saying he wants to take a victory. He will sign anything that is passed.
Yeah, sure, and he'll shine it up, he'll polish it up whenever he gets it. But right now, he's making very clear that he's not going to embrace this thing anytime soon.
No, but he doesn't have to embrace it. He just has to sign it. And then he claims it. And then he says, I've made the greatest, this is the greatest bill that's ever been passed. And the public will not like it. And he will still take a victory lap with it because he needs to have gotten something done. And that's point one about this, which I think is important. And we move on to the second point here, which is, will the potential passage of this bill, coupled with the news this morning that the Supreme Court has allowed aspects of the executive order travel ban to be reinstated pending its review of the case, in October. This is obviously a qualified victory for the White House and for the president that he will presumably spin over the next couple of days into a major victory over his you know, rivals who claim that he's a horrible monster, and makes, to be fair, makes the very specific point, I'll quote it here, in the stay, you know, in the in this decision, the per curiam decision of the White House, that says, okay, when it comes to refugees who lack any such connection, meaning a personal connection through a family member or an institutional connection, meaning that they're enrolled in a school or have a job that they've already have. Refugees who lack any such connection to the United States for the reasons we have set out, the balance tips in favor of the government's compelling need to provide for the nation's security. That quote from the decision speaks to the main claim that the White House makes in favor of the travel ban, which is that the National Security Act of 1952 gives the president enormous powers over immigration as relates to national security. What they say is that if you have a compelling reason to be in the United States that is a personal connection to some aspect, having a blanket ban is not fair. But other bans are within the, as it stands, until they hear otherwise, are within the president's discretion. And more importantly, this decision, which is not a decision, just to reinstate the bill pending its decision, does not say that the president prejudiced his own case because he said stuff on the campaign trail that meant that he, you know, hates all Muslims or that this is a religious test or something like that. They explicitly kept their hands out of that pie. That was what kept these three or four different appeals court and state level court decisions used, right? Was that this was effectively a religious ban, not a, you know, not a national security issue. By signaling that they accept that the president had, president and in immigration has a national security role to play, or a significant national security role to play, they are signaling that this is not going to be a, this is not a layup for the travel bans being overturned when the case is heard by the full court in October.
No, it might not be. It's, you know, it's folly to really kind of guess where the court is going based on the language of something like this. But there's what some of the things that they didn't touch, for example, is the idea that this is supposed to be a stopgap measure, that the original travel ban was in a 90-day program with an expiration date before the administration could get and establish a new immigration policy. Now, as critics noted, that this travel ban was the immigration policy, and it was never going to be overturned. And the fact that we've already gotten to day 160 or whatever it is, without any interest in creating that new immigration policy or any effort to, besides the fact that they've just revised and defended this particular travel ban, suggests that the language was not genuine in the initial effort. And moreover, they refused to stay any sort of implementation of travel ban that would affect people with connection to the country or family here.
Okay, but here's the point. If the Supreme Court rules that the president has plenipotentiary powers over national security, he does not necessarily have to make an argument that the ban, because it was an emergency measure or blah, blah, blah.
Well, as long as it's not discriminatory.
Right. But in other words, he has discretion to say no one could come in the country because I, as the president of the United States, deem this a threat to national security. It was the decision of these appeals of the Hawaii court and the two appeals courts that seemed to suggest that that was not a power that he necessarily possessed, that the law itself says unmistakably that he does, and that there were people, you know, our friend Adam White, who's a Supreme Court scholar and various constitutional scholar, and other people said the great weakness of the case against Trump was this act of simply ignoring the relevant piece of legislation governing the president's power over immigration in favor of a constitutional argument without any procedural argument that the president has been given statutory authority over immigration without Congress's role. Congress ceded this to the president. Now, he can't violate the First Amendment. He can't violate the First Amendment. But that's an important thing that everybody sort of ignored. And I don't know. I think the point is generally that in the shadow game that is politics, being able to say in the space of 10 days, let's say, the travel ban was reinstated over Democratic objections, and that he got, after all everyone said it was dead, he got a health care bill to his desk and signed it, changes the dynamic in the United States over the Trump presidency after 6 months of the presidency. That's, I would assert that. So did either of you want to argue with it, make a counter case?
Well, the first thing is that depends on whether or not this all happens.
Right.
This is a subjunctive. So
right.
You,
right. But the other point is I wouldn't, in fact, I would be surprised if by the time these things did come through for him, there weren't new sorts of ugly festering policy wounds or structural problems that he was now presiding over that makes him look every bit as incompetent.
Noah?
Yeah, just about every problem that this administration has encountered has been self-inflicted. It has to do with the agenda of the Bannon wing asserting itself in reckless ways that reflect poorly on the president or backfire entirely on the president. Donald Trump is inclined to tweet things that undermine his own position. His wiretapping tweet a few steps down the road resulted in Devin Nunes having to recuse himself, joining Jeff Sessions having to recuse himself.
Okay, so Devin Nunes was the head of the House Intelligence Committee, and he said he was recusing himself because he allowed himself to get involved in this bizarre kabuki dance where he was handed information on... What's that term? Unmasking. But he was given it by the White House, but he pretended it wasn't from the White, whatever. So we had this House...
Wiretapping and tapes. Tapes resulted in the special prosecution, according to Donald Trump. According to James Comey himself, it was Donald Trump's, "I hope there's no tapes out there" tweet that led to James Comey leaking his memos to the press with the explicit intention of compelling the Deputy Attorney General to hand the investigation into the Trump campaign over to a special counsel. These are all of Trump's making, and without them, we'd probably be talking about a much more successful presidency. So right now we're talking about, this is how starved of accomplishments this administration is. We're talking about events that have yet to occur and probably will, as Abe said, a whole bunch of things will happen down the road. Whatever health care bill passes, and I think something will pass, it's not going to be what's in front of them right now. We're all agreed on that. We have no idea if this travel ban is going to survive in its present iteration. I'd suggest it probably won't.
Okay, but we're not going to hear about that for 6 months to a year.
Precisely.
So I'm just saying he can claim a victory lap. He needs one substantive legislative achievement, which may be on him. So it's also possible that he'll screw it up. I mean, obviously that seems to be his MO, is that he screws himself up.
But this administration has had accomplishments before that sort of seem really important in the time and prove ephemeral over the course of a couple of days or weeks.
Like what?
Well, I'm having a trouble remembering. I know, that's because they're so ephemeral. But I feel like
the one big Rose Garden dance was over the passage of the House version of this bill that's now being debated by the Senate. So I don't know what huge accomplishment there is,
but you know what the difference is? I mean, Trump never, even in victory, Trump doesn't act.
There was the bombing of Syria, which was followed by nothing, right?
So right, okay. And he doesn't act like the victor, really, when he wins. And what I mean by that is, I was thinking about when we were talking about his inability to sell health care. Unwillingness. And this would go for the travel ban, too. And the difference between he and Obama, if you remember, every time Obama put out some, every time he was pushing for some accomplishment, some legislative accomplishment, when it was Obamacare, whether it was the Iran deal, whitehouse.gov would organize, where they would put up some beautiful PDF with a White House, letterhead, right, and it was all nonsense, but it would have these sort of bullet-pointed lists of the benefits that he was, that the president was now bringing to the country. These many, these people would be covered. These many people would be able to afford it. This level of uranium, you wouldn't be able to enrich to this level. The deal would only sunset after a certain point. And everyone would cut and paste these propaganda pamphlets, and they would, and these would become the talking points for their whole side, and this would become the sort of first draft of the accomplishment. Trump does none of that, and so that's part of why all these things just sort of, they look desperate, like he just, by the skin of his teeth, he just got this confused thing to happen,
right?
And now what's next?
Right. Well, that's really the question, is whether that appearance can be changed by actual events. We don't know if events are going to happen. We don't know if he'll sell it right. We know that he'll oversell it. But maybe that's what you have to do. And particularly if people are screaming that he's committing mass murder, and he's like, I'm not committing mass, I'm saving the American healthcare system. You say I'm committing mass murder, right. We'll see. Let's see how many people are dead in a year. And if no one's dead in a year, or people are in better shape than they were before, what apology are you going to make? What are you going to quit? Are you going to like say you were wrong? I mean, whatever. Right. You know, that's one way that you could fight this.
Right.
The other major thing that happened today was a very significant decision in the Supreme Court on religious liberty and government interference in Missouri. This very odd case involving the state's department of the state refusing to allow a church with a daycare center to participate in a program to safety-proof their playground using spare tires. State had refused on the grounds that providing this to a church would be an unconstitutional favoring of religion, and in a kind of remarkable 7-2 decision in which Justices Breyer and Ginsburg both joined the majority. The decision written by Chief Justice Roberts said very explicitly that it is not the state can rule on what it is that someone wishes to do with a subsidy. If the subsidy that is provided is used to further a religious purpose, then that is something on which the state has grounds to say that would be a favoring of religion. But the state is not permitted to rule against something on the basis of what it is or who they are. Meaning if they're a church, that they're a church doesn't mean that they are not permitted to receive a government benefit because they're a church. That is a disfavoring of religion. It's not that the state is neutral to religion. It's actively taking active measures against a religious institution that it would not take against a secular institution. This is a very significant ruling. The ruling itself, in a footnote, attempts to limit its scope. Footnote number 3 attempts to limit the scope of the decision by saying this is only about playgrounds. Judge Gorsuch, in the first significant piece of writing that he has done as a Supreme Court justice, objected to this notion that, you know, that it's only about this. And I want to find this. Oh, here it is. Okay, so here's what he wrote. Quote, first, the court leaves open the possibility a useful distinction might be drawn between laws that discriminate on the basis of religious status and religious use. Respectfully, I harbor doubts about the stability of such a line. Does a religious man say grace before dinner, or does a man begin his meal in a religious manner? Is it a religious group that built the playground, or did a group build the playground so that it might be used to advance a religious mission? The distinction blurs in much the same way the line between acts and omissions can blur when stared at too long, leaving us to ask, for example, whether the man who drowns by awaiting the incoming tide does so by act, coming upon the sea, or omission, allowing the sea to come upon him. So I'm saying to you that Justice Scalia may have been succeeded in his seat by somebody who has an equally beautiful command of the English language and who may be writing decisions and concurrences and dissents that we will be studying and arguing over and wondering at the beauty of the language used for decades to come.
So I have some thoughts on this, and I want to put it to both of you. This seems like it's one of those decisions that would be unthinkable 40 years ago, or even 30 years ago, and not just because of the makeup of the Supreme Court, but of the makeup of the culture. Over the course of the last 10 years, the United States has become a lot more conservative culturally, and those cultural preconceptions are reflected in court precedents, particularly when it comes to the expansion of rights and privileges in the First and Second Amendments. They have been expanded exponentially when it comes to decisions in Citizens United, McCutcheon, Hobby Lobby, and now this, and to say nothing of the expansion of Second Amendment's privileges in cities and localities that are otherwise predisposed to be hostile towards firearm ownership. And these are some of the things that conservatives, I think, don't do themselves any justice on, is by failing to appreciate the cultural victories that they have achieved over the course of the last quarter century, which are significant, tangible, reflect a country that is moving farther to the right than I think any of them really want to believe. And this is just another element of that rightward drift.
Abe?
I think your point is well taken. I don't know that I'd define it as a cultural change, actually, though, because to my mind, the culture has not become more conservative. I think these are sort of quiet, unheralded victories, constitutional victories and legal victories that I think protect a smaller and smaller conservative minority.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with this either in this sense, which is that I do believe that there is a jurisprudence involving the First and Second Amendments that is much more robust than it was in the decades before it. That said, partially that's because there has been a challenge on religious liberty and speech of a sort that we did not see in the decades before, and that is part of the I would say the on march of cultural liberalism and secularism that have been staging a very aggressive assault on these freedoms, on the notion that it's okay to curtail speech in the 60 days before an election because somehow it favors rich people, any religious person exercising the free exercise of religion can be found to be violating somebody else's freedom if you look hard enough, push. I mean, there's a case Supreme Court has agreed to hear in Colorado involving a baker who did not wish to bake a cake for a gay marriage. Okay, it's an interesting case. It's more complicated than that. The significant part about this case is that the couple that wished him to bake the cake are from Massachusetts, which is to say that they wanted a guy in Colorado to bake a cake for them in Massachusetts. Why did they want to do this? Because they wanted him to say no so they could sue him, so that they could make him a test case, so that they could prevent him from exercising his free choice as a private citizen to serve his own religious principles as he saw fit. This was an aggression against him by another party, not something that he did, unwittingly or without scruple. He's got an important case to make. This is a case that they will hear next year. But I mean, there would be no such religious liberty case were the liberty not being tested, the bounds of religious liberty and individual expression being tested by people who want to destroy, I believe, the notion that religious liberty is something that the United States needs to take seriously, as opposed to, whatever cultural fashion might exist at the moment. Now, people are going to get angry at me because they're going to say gay marriage is not a cultural fashion, but that doesn't mean that an individual person who has a religious belief that says that gay marriage is violative of his own personal beliefs is then compelled as a private citizen to, is forced as a private citizen to create a product for somebody else that he wishes not to create. It's not an accommodation law. It's not that there's an existing room that he won't let somebody in or existing. It's that he is to invent and make something, is ordered to make something for somebody else that he does not wish to make. That is a very significant breach of individual liberty, in my view, and so that I think, anyway, it's an interesting moment because, you know, it means that the culture war on some of this is not over yet. There's constant efforts to declare the culture war over, and all arguments have ceased, and all. And, you know, it's simply the fact that this is a, that there's a lot of aggression, there's a lot of aggressive efforts to limit the freedom of others in defense of your own unlimited freedom. And, you know, in a civil society, people make compacts to preserve their own individual liberty by allowing other people to exercise their own. And when we get into struggles like that, then the Supreme Court is forced to adjudicate. We'll see what they come up with. And with that, we come to the end of another crushing. I think this does not qualify as a crushing Morosity podcast. I don't think our friend who declared us, complained about our crushing Morosity could say that this was a crushingly, even though Noah's got a head cold and I was up half the night with heartburn.
But since I'm so cheery today,
Abe has lifted the spirits of us all with his high good cheer. It's a beautiful day in New York. It's been a beautiful weekend in New York. Summer is upon us, you know.
Emotionally,
Ludi sing cuckoo, as they sang. That's Summer is a coming in. Great medieval poem.
Okay.
Summer is a coming. Ludi sing cuckoo, cuckoo, cuckoo. Nothing. I got
no, nothing. No,
okay.
But it's not morose.
I know it's the opposite of morose. I'm saying Ludi sing cuckoo. I don't know why that's a problem. So, and with that we bid you a fond farewell. And for Noah Rothman and Abe Greenwald, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.